You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. We wanted to give you a quick news roundup before we turn to the second part of my conversation with Brody Mullins, an amazing writer who wrote a book called The Wolves of K Street. And part of what that book talks about is the foreign influence that has made its way into the political process of the United States. It's a very important read for national security lawyers, and we think you'll enjoy our conversation with him. But before we get to that, there's some news this week to report and something to remember. So first, on the good news front for sanctions fans, Russia apparently has been forced to start storing gas from Vladimir Putin's flagship Arctic project in a sign that Western sanctions are deterring buyers, so reports the Financial Times. According to ship tracking data and satellite images, three vessels have shipped liquefied natural gas from Arctic LNG 2, which is under U.S. sanctions, since it started loading operations last month. One of the ships, Everest Energy, appears to have unloaded at the SOM FSU, a floating storage unit anchored in a bay in the Murmansk region of northern Russia. It has since headed back in the direction of the Arctic LNG 2. So the transfer underscores the challenges that Russia faces in finding buyers for sanctioned LNG. Maybe sometimes sanctions work. And in other news, Polish flag yachts are now being used by criminals to export cocaine and other drugs across the Atlantic from South America to Europe and elsewhere. So this is a new concern. You should listen to any of our podcasts on the shipping industry and some of the problems that exist in an industry that, while it's regulated, is international in scope and takes place largely away from national law enforcement eyes. In other news, Iranian-backed actors are seeking access to senior U.S. political figures' email accounts, and they have launched covert news sites aimed at American readers as part of an increased disinformation and cyber attack ahead of our elections. If this surprises you, I'd be shocked. But anyway, Microsoft is the one that put that report out. You should take a look. One of the other things we're talking about in sanctions is some things, export controls, things you can't send overseas. And right now, NVIDIA chips is one of those items. It's important to understand that access to a chip of this capacity would be an advantage for the Chinese, who haven't been able to quite come up with this technology on their own. But apparently, a recent undercover investigation by reporters from Bloomberg and the New York Times has discovered that, in fact, you can find NVIDIA chips in China, in particular markets, and people are talking about the ease with which they can be acquired despite the export control rules governing them. Now, Supreme Court watchers, for your interest, if you've been looking at the foreign government's use of social media sites in order to exert influence over the United States population and fuel our differences, be aware that the oral argument is now scheduled for September 16th, meaning this month, in the case of Based Politics, Inc. versus Merrick Garland, which has a lot to do with the proposed TikTok ban. So keep your eyes on that one. It's coming up. And this is an important and somber week in the world of national security, because it was 23 years ago that we were attacked by a group headed then by a few different people, directed by Ashura Council. And those people included Ayman al-Zawahiri and, of course, Osama bin Laden, neither one of whom is around really anymore. But on that date, 3,000 people lost their lives. Our exalted institutions, including the Pentagon, were attacked. The World Trade Center was felled, and we were forever changed. The attack on Pearl Harbor at that point looked like a minor incursion. Today, we remember the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, something that we should never, never forget. And we should continue the spirit of upholding peace and security and try to inspire others with our American values by holding true to them, even in a time of great political differences and in a time of hostile election campaigns. The fight against terrorism was noted by, believe it or not, President Reagan as something that's a collective responsibility. It's vital to the preservation of our civilization. He described terrorism as something that it is, which is cynical and a remorseless enemy of peace. So on this date, we remember the fine Americans who lost their lives on 9/11, and we do our best to forget the wicked people behind that attack. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the second part of my conversation with Brody Mullins. Let's talk for a second about the Fourth Estate, because I did open by saying that you're a member of the Fourth Estate, and one of the things in Washington that just blows me away is the number of members of the press who seem to have very close relationships to these people. And of course, I wonder, looking at that, is that a good idea? Shouldn't you be really upholding your role in serving the Fourth Estate? And why don't you talk a little bit about the role between the press and some of these power brokers?
Yeah, it's admittedly a little complicated, but I think there's two sides of the coin. I mean, one is, you know, obviously reporters in Washington should be covering not just who's voting for the laws and legislation, but who's behind pushing the laws and legislation to be made the way they are in the first place. And that is oftentimes companies. And so one, I think that reporters should be writing about companies and lobbying and sort of influence peddlers in DC who are really pulling the levers behind the scenes. Two, though, you know, a lot of those companies are trying to influence reporters themselves. I mean, members of Congress and staff get their information from various sources. They get information directly from lobbyists, they're from their friends, from their staff, you know, and from the publications they read. When I was a young reporter, I worked for Roll Call newspaper, and I also worked for a place called Congress Daily. And those places, you know, I wrote about what bills up, what bills down, who's going to be the next subcommittee chairman, you know, who's got power and who doesn't have power. And companies really care about that stuff. And companies try to lobby, try to get their messages to members of Congress through those Capitol Hill publications. So in a way, lobbyists are targeting reporters to get their message to members of Congress as well. But finally, while I think that reporters should write about what lobbyists are doing and how they're trying to put their thumb on the scale, I always found lobbyists to be a tremendous resource for my reporting. Because if I'm covering a subcommittee, you know, I can do my best to call all 26 members of Congress on the subcommittee or their chief of staff or their press secretary. But lobbyists have huge teams and far more resources than I have to actually have those conversations. So I would call members of Congress, but I would also call lobbyists to hear what they're hearing. So sometimes it's sort of a symbiotic relationship where reporters are close with lobbyists as a way to get information on what's going on in Washington or on Capitol Hill.
And all that sounds reasonable. I think what jumps out at me is the planting of stories, which is not okay. In my view, that should be an editorial choice of a professional news outlet. That's number one. And then number two is sort of the blurring of personal lines. There are romantic relationships between these two groups. And I think that can sometimes become an issue.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, one of the things that we wrote about in one of our characters is how he sort of created a lobbying or an influence peddling business that was designed to get the corporate view into publications in Washington in order to influence members of Congress. One way that members of Congress get their information is through these Capitol Hill publications. And this guy tried to befriend as many reporters as he could on behalf of big clients, you know, like Goldman Sachs and Boeing and foreign countries like Ethiopia and Saudi Arabia. So sort of trying to get the messages from his big corporate and foreign clients to members of Congress by planting stories in the Capitol Hill media.
The problem with all of this is we really only have a couple of laws that seem to directly address this behavior. And one of them is the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And we've done several podcasts on that, including the origins of that, the issues with respect to sort of the Nazi foreign influence campaign leading up to World War II and some of the investigations that were done by O. John Rogan at the Justice Department. And then there's the law requiring the registration of lobbyists. I can only imagine how broadly they must claim topics that they're lobbying on and how vague that must be in most instances. But have you thought about whether or not those laws have any effect on sort of quelling this practice, this unappealing practice of being paid by foreign governments, lobbying for big companies that have no interest in serving the American public? What are your thoughts on sort of there? Is that a gaping hole, a yawning hole in our legal system? And how can we trust Congress to do anything when they seem to be getting, you know, donations from the companies that are trying to change the laws and gain a competitive advantage?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a little hard to answer because for most of my life and for the most of the life of FARA, it was really not enforced. And so that people who are essentially foreign agents, people who are lobbying for foreign countries or advising them or doing public relations for them, simply wouldn't fill out the forms. And the Justice Department never went after them. And therefore, it sort of was an unwritten rule in DC that you didn't really need to fill out these forms. And so that few people did. Everything changed, though, with Manafort. I mean, when the Justice Department and the Mueller investigation, you know, went after Manafort for him failing to file his FARA forms on behalf of his government clients in Ukraine, all of a sudden, people who were doing foreign work and who hadn't filed forms all of a sudden said, oh, crap, you know, and they started filing forms like crazy. So there's far more. If you look at the numbers, there's a huge spike in the number of FARA lobbyists in the last couple of years. And that's not because there's more FARA lobbyists. That's just because people are filling out their forms for the first time. So the reason I say I can't answer the question is that I think things haven't really shaken out yet to see if there are people who are getting out of that business. I think there could be people who are worried about the scrutiny all of a sudden on foreign lobbying. But if you're a foreign country, you know, there's no shortage of the number of people you can hire. So, you know, I'm not sure if it's put any dent into that business yet.
So two thoughts on that. Let me just point out for our listeners who don't know, I mean, in the case of Manafort, he wasn't representing Ukraine. We think of the current iteration of Ukraine. He was representing a Kremlin aligned.
He was a pro-Russian president of Ukraine about 10 years ago.
Who fled to Russia. Let's add that. You know, he correct. Ultimately hot-footed it right back to safety. So, I mean, that wasn't a small thing, and it was kind of a big deal. Now, with respect to the registration and getting out of it, I mean, a couple of things come to mind. I kind of wanted to get your reaction to this. Yeah, a lot of these countries who are spending these millions of dollars on lobbying Congress have also received aid packages from the United States, sometimes in billions of dollars. And then they're turning around and spending millions of that back to influence Congress. I just wonder, I'd like to get your reaction to that. I mean, there seems to be a circle here.
Yeah, it seems to be a problem. And also, unfortunately, for a foreign country, you know, a great return on their investment. You know, you spend a couple million dollars on lobbying and you get a couple billion back. I mean, everyone should be doing that. Everyone should be so lucky to be able to do that. But that definitely is what it seems like, is these foreign countries, you know, want U.S. aid. They don't know how to get it. Washington, Congress, the foreign relations committees are all extremely complicated and hard to figure out. But you can hire a former staffer for one of those committees or a former State Department official to help, you know, sort of get your aid application, as it were, you know, in the hands of the right people and make your case to the right people. And you can get billions of dollars. And when Paul Manafort was a young lobbyist in the 1980s in the Reagan administration, that's really how he cut his teeth, is representing foreign countries and helping them get aid or recognition from the Reagan administration.
What incentive would Congress have here to enact some laws that would protect against, let's just call it, influence peddling on this level?
So that's a tough question. It usually takes a scandal to get Congress to do anything on ethics or lobbying, and there currently is no scandal. In fact, there's multiple scandals, but none that seem to be rising to the level of getting a lot of attention on the Hill. But I would think that a member of Congress would want to know, hey, who am I talking to? When I'm walking around my district and going to the grocery store, walking through the airport, and some seemingly normal constituents come up to me and saying, hey, have you seen this ad on, you know, prescription drugs, you should vote yes or no. I would want to know, is that person actually being paid by a lobbying organization? I mean, those are the types of things that are falling beneath the current disclosure regime. I would think members of Congress would want to say, hey, just let me know who's for and against all these policies. Who are the people who are supporting these lobbying campaigns? So then I can decide. And right now, because the disclosure laws are so terrible, you don't know if you're being lobbied by a corporate interest or if you're just talking to a, you know, well-intentioned constituent.
We talked for a second here about how much money has to be spent now just to run for office. They're smelling jet fuel on Thursday. For people who don't know, they get on planes on Thursday. If you were to go out to Reagan National Airport, I don't know, do they still have their own parking lot? I think they do.
I don't know if they still have
they don't have a parking lot. Do you remember that?
I do that. If they don't have the parking lot, they certainly still have a young 20-year-old aide driving them directly to the airport for them.
Okay, that's all kinds of wrong. But anyway, they're out there. Thursday, they're leaving. They're going home. And the reason they're going home is they're not there just to visit with their constituents. They got to raise money. I mean, there was a time in Washington where they would stay on the weekends. And they'd actually talk to each other. Republicans, Democrats, they lived in neighborhoods where there were community pools. Their kids would swim together, be on the swim team, and they would talk to each other and they solve problems.
There's lots of things here that need to go wrong in order to create this terrible system that we have right now. And one of them is television advertising and the cost of campaigns, which really changed with the advent of television and in the 1950s and 1960s. And members of Congress now to run for re-election want to be on TV more than their opponent. And those TV ads cost more and more and more because everyone wants to be on TV at the same time. And that's caused the TV advertising cost to skyrocket. Therefore, members of Congress need to pay for those ads. And how do you pay for those ads? You need to raise money. And where do you get money? From corporations. You know, companies and their lobbyists have put themselves right at the center of the fundraising operations for members of Congress. And therefore, you know, if you are a member of Congress and you're relying on a lobbyist or a group of corporate lobbyists to raise you millions of dollars, well, when those lobbyists come back and say, hey, you know, member of Congress X, I'm so glad that you got reelected. By the way, my client has some problem with some bill you're writing, or, you know, has a problem with something going on at the EPA. Could you write a letter, or could you add this amendment to this bill that's moving, you know, that would help me out? You know, a member of Congress is going to be open to that. And that's just the terrible system that we have.
Yeah. And you talked a little bit about there is a First Amendment right to things like advertising for businesses, and the Supreme Court ruled that way in, I believe, the 1970s. But there was the Citizens United case, which seems, upon looking at it, to be pretty horrifying in terms of further empowering corporations to spend money on campaigns and to have greater influence. You almost draw a line between some of these scandals and the populist movement that we're seeing afoot in the United States right now. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and sort of how you view the impact of Citizens United, because I thought that was one little bonus in the book that I wasn't really expecting.
Yeah, so I have a different take on Citizens United than most people have. The companies that I've spoken to, the corporate lobbyists and the big time fundraisers who work for these super PACs, have said that, you know, Citizens United was a 2010 Supreme Court decision that made it clear for the first time that anyone, individuals, billionaires, companies, labor unions, can spend millions of dollars on campaign ads without restriction. It made that legal. Before 2010, it was thought that companies and labor unions could not do that, but individuals have always had that right. The media stories since 2010 have said that this has opened the floodgates to companies donating millions of dollars to super PACs. But, you know, I've looked at the campaign filing reports and I just don't see the corporate money. It has led to a flood of money into politics. But most of that money, to me, has come from billionaires who are donating tens of millions, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars to super PACs. But companies have not given much money. The one exception there is the energy industry. Big oil and gas companies are giving tons of money, mostly to Republican allied campaign groups. But other companies are worried about their brands, and they're comfortable donating through their PACs to Republicans and to Democrats, but they're not comfortable writing $1 million check to put their thumb on the scale for one presidential candidate or another. So I just don't see that as much.
Well, let's talk about the big tech companies and sort of the billionaires that run them. I'm using privacy laws because I know those will cost a company. There'll be a cost for compliance, a potential loss of revenue. You know, the entire thing is not free, and it's built on the idea that they're going to harvest your data and sell it for targeted advertising. And that's the way that you're able to access things like Google's search or enjoy free videos on YouTube. You're the product. And if that business model is that business model, and Congress were to go in the direction more of the European model and begin to siphon back some of the data that these companies are able to harvest and use, then, you know, that could be potentially a big problem. But I'm looking at some of these, I call them tech bros. They are very powerful, very wealthy, and some of them of late have been odd. They seem to be trying to reclaim their missed adolescence. They missed it for sure. It's pretty clear, you know, jettisoning their wives like excess baggage, posting shirtless pictures of themselves on social media and the mistaken belief that anyone wants to see that, or opining on matters of politics and statesmanship between ketamine hits. So why don't you talk about the companies that have lobbied Congress and tech companies? How much is spent by big tech? Because this is, I think, where people are starting to become alarmed.
Yeah. So in the last 10 years, maybe a little bit longer, you know, the major big tech companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, have really spent more money lobbying Washington, more money to influence Washington than anyone else. The pharmaceutical industry, the big drug companies, used to be the biggest spender in DC, and they're now being eclipsed by tech. You know, the tech companies are also the biggest employers in the US. They're the largest companies by market capitalization. They have global influence, you know, as you mentioned, and they've got a ton at stake. They have been incredibly lightly regulated so far in the 10 or 20 years since these companies have, most of these companies have been in existence. Washington hasn't laid a glove on them until very recently.
Telecommunications Decency Act has protected them pretty well.
Yeah, and all sorts of other laws have as well. So, you know, for 20 years or 10 years, they've basically gotten everything they wanted. Now, that is just starting to change now. One, you know, with the DOJ's win a few weeks ago against Google. And, you know, DOJ has another case against Google that starts in September. And the FTC has a case against Amazon, has another case against Apple. So there's a chance that things are changing in the courts or by the regulatory agencies. But more importantly, I think the American people are starting to feel like these companies are too big and have too much influence over their lives, over their privacy and other matters. And then now we're starting to see more about how much is social media hurting our children. I mean, you mentioned the Jonathan Haidt book. So there's more and more concerns that these products that we think are free or have said in the past are free, like search or social media, maybe actually have a cost to society that that should be reined in. So anyway, the point is, it seems like more and more Americans are turning against the companies. More and more members of Congress seem to be turning against the companies. And that is both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, J.D. Vance seems to be against big tech, and so is Jonathan Cantor, and so is Lina Khan. So, I mean, you know, elections have consequences. But in this election, when it comes to tech, it seems like both sides could come in with an anti-tech antitrust enforcement regime.
I mean, you've done investigative reporting. What did you make of the sudden publication by CRS of potential remedies to monopolies?
I can't tell what's going on there. Is this an effort by tech-friendly members of Congress to push back on the court's decision, or is it Congress trying to jump in on the game? You know, Congress has done nothing for 20 years on this topic. Are they suddenly jumping in and saying, oh, yeah, we agree? You know, I couldn't quite get a read on that.
I couldn't either, but now I see a villain hiding around every corner, every wall. All right, well, let's take 1 minute. So tell me, because you've been covering stuff for a lot of years, you obviously do very diligent research. What are the news stories that you are watching today?
Well, you know, I wish I could say I'm not following the presidential election and I have something more interesting to talk about. But, you know, it's obviously the most fascinating thing that's going on right now. And it seems to me like it's 50-50. I mean, Democrats obviously have a lot of momentum from the last couple of weeks, as, you know, any party should have after its convention. I kind of wonder, like, how long Democrats can keep this momentum up. I mean, we're used to a very, very fast news cycle, and we've got 2 months till the election. I can't see Democrats keeping this momentum, but it seems like they are for a couple of weeks. So, you know, that's definitely the major thing that I've been following. And I've really been following it actually from an antitrust point of view. I mean, I really feel like antitrust and this battle we have over big companies and over Google and over Amazon is really going to be the most important economic issue in the next 20 years. And it seems like no matter who wins, they're going to come in with strong antitrust regulators, which is really a surprise. That's really been a shift in the last 5 or 6 years from the previous 50 years in Washington.
Well, we'll see. We have a short attention span now, you know, because we like those dopamine hits as we're death scrolling. And, you know, it's like Somar, whatever that drug was they took in Brave New World. I'll tell you what I'm watching. So the head of Telegram, who is Pavel Durov, he's been arrested in France. This is a, you know, an encrypted communications application that is used for a lot of not great things, child porn, sharing, drug trafficking, fraud, that kind of thing. And what's interesting is so are a lot of platforms. And he's now locked up. And I can only imagine that a guy like Elon Musk or anyone running a platform right now, and Elon's got his own issues, I guess, after the revelations that Peter Avin, you know, who is basically a former insider in Russia, is one of the donors or one of the people who helped him, I guess, buy X. But anyway, this Russian-born 39-year-old guy who runs or founded Telegram, not only was he held for the typical, whatever it is, 72 hours, but they've now extended it 4 days. So it's going to be an interesting case to watch from a national security perspective. And I wonder, if there's not going to be some fallout from that arrest. And I wonder what it's going to look like when it does happen. So what's your reaction to that?
You know, Elon Musk is a guy who I've followed closely for the last 2 or 3 or 4 years. It seems like he is also riding pretty high with, you know, Twitter/X plus, you know, SpaceX now being the dominant player and Tesla. So it'd be interesting to see if any of that could pierce his veil, but we'll have to see about that.
Well, it may be offset by the fact that SpaceX is now going to have to rescue stranded astronauts, which is a really pretty big deal. Another story I'm watching, and I thought I'd bring it up to you as a journalist, is that a jury in Nevada has found a Democratic former Las Vegas area politician guilty of murdering a guy named Jeff German, who was an investigative journalist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and who had covered this guy, this politician, whose name was Jeff Tellez, for, I guess, wrongdoing, malfeasance. What was your reaction to a journalist? I imagine you've heard about this verdict.
I almost feel like you can switch those last two stories. I mean, this sounds like something that would happen in Russia with oligarchs and Putin-tied thugs. I mean, for this to happen in the United States of America is crazy.
Well, I think there was a firearm involved there. It would have been a poison tea, or they would have fallen out a window or downstairs. Mm-hmm. They're clumsy. And then amusingly, too, I don't know if you noticed this one, but this comes from August 16th, which is that Turkish parliament, we've been talking about Congress, you know, they're performative these days. They love to squabble, but it broke out in a fistfight. The entire parliament got involved. There are videos of this where one guy hits the other guy. So one, and this is a member of parliament. I mean, we're not talking about like somebody in the viewing gallery or anything. And there was blood on the floor when this was over. You think we have a problem?
Well, I mean, there have been some challenges of fistfights in the last year or so on Capitol Hill. So maybe that's the next step.
All right. But the real big story, and the one I think we're going to be covering on NSLT, or we're going to be looking at, is the Chinese government hackers have apparently penetrated U.S. internet providers for the purpose of espionage. So I know our listeners are interested in that. And I know there have been comments from the CISA, and we will certainly be covering that more extensively and talking about the history of that, as well as China's current plan for cognitive warfare, which, who knows, you know, maybe some of these lobbyists or foreign influence peddlers will inadvertently find themselves embroiled in the middle of that. But let's hope not. All right. Well, thank you for listening to NSLT. Our guest tonight has been Brody Mullins. And how the heck did you write a book with your brother without like clobbering each other?
Well, who says we didn't? No, I'm kidding. We
like a Turkish member of parliament.
Exactly. So it turns out that, you know, being raised as brothers, like one of the things you learn is how to get in those fights and how to recover from those fights. So, you know, we certainly got in tons of arguments and disputes over things, but we also know that we love each other. Our parents would be tremendously upset if we harbored any resentment. So we always knew how to get back together and move the ball forward.
Well, it's an amazing accomplishment. I mean, it's been a while since I read a book that really kind of drew me in quite this way.
Well, thank you.
You can find the link to this book in the notes to our podcast. But we do encourage you to visit a local brick and mortar bookstore instead of death scrolling, because we know that if you're death scrolling, you're contributing to the demise of civilization. You know it. We know it. Stop it. So read the book. And if you're a national security lawyer thinking about a legal fix to the problem of foreign influence peddling, and we hope you are, you need to read this and start thinking about how we might solve this problem. And thanks so much to Brody for coming. We hope that you'll come back and join us when you have another book.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend. Remember to discuss any topics we cover in a thoughtful way, hearing other people's opinions and arguments. Believe me, it'll improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country that is more diverse in thought, not just ethnicity, than any other country. Our producer, writer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. My co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the amazing Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. And today we welcome Antasia, who's going to be helping us with our podcasts going forward. And that's why they're going to be so much better. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.